If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Well, if you're listening to Louis Armstrong singing What a Wonderful World, then it's got to be Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pives. And I am offering and extending a warm welcome to one of my heroes, Alistair Harding. Alistair, welcome to Real People.
Thank you very much. Jerry, you know, it's really interesting. You've chosen What a Wonderful World. At the end of the show, I understand you're going to be playing my music, the music that I've chosen. And What a Wonderful World was actually one of the songs that I was thinking about putting on that list. I didn't in the end. So it's really lovely that you've used it now. The reason that I wanted to use it was because it was the song that I remember a lot about my grandmother. So you've given me an extra song there. Thank you.
I use this phrase, Alistair, rubber banding. And it's a phrase used in my psychotherapy approach, transactional analysis. And it came 50 years before anyone talked about trauma triggers, where some music or incident or even faces and people literally rubber band us, like we're being pulled on a rubber band. And suddenly we get thrown back to another place, another time. And I think music does that powerfully. What do you think?
Absolutely, I do. And I mean, we'll touch on this again during the music segment. But that's a big part of what I do as a filmmaker, actually, is when you're trying to tell a story, you're trying to put people into a place and have them understand what is actually going on, not just in the physical world, but also in the emotional world. And so I totally understand what you're talking about there with rubber banding, because essentially that's what we're talking about when we're choosing music to go along with images in my films, is trying to rubber band, to use your expression, people into that moment, into that emotional state, so that they can understand the story even better. It's not just a case of showing people vision. It's about actually putting them in that place. I'm not sure whether that actually answers your question.
Alistair, I've got a horrible feeling that you and I could be talking for like 7 or 8 hours, not just one. It does actually answer my question. But for the listeners, let me just introduce you properly. Let me do my job properly. So we're talking to Alistair Harding, who began his career as a journalist in 1998 in New Zealand, and a brief stint in Australia. But Alistair spent 18 years in Singapore working in publishing, branding, and then television production before returning to New Zealand in 2018. Working in the corporate world, doing a whole bunch of stuff, but it's the documentary film space that Alistair is most well known to all of us. If you're listening in, you'll know, I hope. And if you don't, you should just stop listening now and go and watch it. We Came Here for Freedom, Alistair's two-part film about the Wellington Parliament occupation. And as well as that, Alistair's got a feature-length film, which was an award-winning film, called The Sea Decides, about the Kiwi adventurer Grant Rawlinson. And just to shout out, Alistair's now running a new series called In Focus, which is aimed at producing original documentaries on the issues that are otherwise not being covered, well, what a surprise, by legacy media. I don't believe it, Alistair. You mean legacy media is not covering important issues? I'm shocked to the core. Goodness me, let me just pick myself up off the floor.
They cover them. They just cover different viewpoints, I suppose, don't they?
Yes.
That's what we're doing with RCR, isn't it? That's what we're trying to fill that gap that they've left, that niche.
Yeah. I'd love to know what you're working on next, but is it top secret?
There are a couple of top secret ones at the moment, but in with concerns to the In Focus show for Reality Check Radio, we're working on one about managed retreat at the moment. I've been filming that up and down the country, And it's a fascinating topic, which I think a lot of people are going to be very interested in, because I think most New Zealanders, it's going to come and touch them in one way or another, especially if you live along the coast.
Right. Wow. Very interesting. So let's come back to your grandmother, because we started off saying this. I always start with what a wonderful world, because I think it lifts me. And you said it rubber banded you back to your grandma. So let's dive straight in and tell me about the grandma that this rubber banded you back to.
Well, I suppose when you're talking about it, it's not just grandma, it's also, you know, our family history. Especially from that was my father's side of the family. And they were farmers. And my grandfather came back from the war, the Second World War, and where he'd fought at the likes of Al Alamein. And he ended up on a farm just north of Hamilton, up in the hills there. And that's where a lot of what I've become was formed on that farm. Everything from work ethic to, I suppose, the musical styles that we enjoy as well. And that particular song was one that my grandmother had played at her funeral. She had requested for it to be played at her funeral. And it sort of just sums up who she was and what that world was that we grew up in, which was this world of, I guess, wonder in the natural world. And so when you go further afield and you grow up, and, you know, as you mentioned in my bio there, that I spent many, many, many years living overseas, to the point where when I came back, we live on a lifestyle block now, out in the middle of the countryside, and I had to go and buy, when I came back from Singapore and we moved here, I had to go and buy a lawnmower. I had to go and buy a ride-on lawnmower, and I had to actually admit to the lawnmower salesman that I hadn't mowed a lawn in my entire adult life. That's how long I spent away in Australia and Singapore. But it's coming home. It's rubber banding me back to, you know, where we came from. And that was that farm that, you know, you're alluding to when you're asking about my grandmother. That's my overriding memory, is that farm where we learned to play and explore and also work. You know, that was a big part of my work ethic, I suppose, was found on that farm. You know, the farm work doesn't stop, and kids get out there and help as well. And yeah, that's a big part of me.
That's left me wondering, actually, whether your grandfather, how he coped with coming back after that war. Was he affected? I mean, of course he was affected. What a stupid question. But, you know, how did the war, the Second World War, impact on your family, do you think?
There were some really obvious ways that you saw. For instance, when you sat at the dining room table at that farm, we were forever looked over by two pictures, one of his brother who had died in the war, and secondly, my grandmother's brother who died in the war. And so there were constant reminders of the war, you know, those reminders of those two brothers who had, I don't believe they ever met each other, but they were also the reason for our family. They were the reason that my grandparents got together. The story went that my grandfather was friends with my grandmother's brother during the war, and he went to see him in hospital. At one point, or in a tent or something, he saw a picture of my grandmother, and he said, "Is that your girlfriend?" And my grandmother's brother said, "No, that's my sister. You know, you should look her up when you go home." And soon after that, my grandfather actually did go home on leave, and he went and met my grandmother, and they went out for a date. And I believe it was actually on that first date when he walked up the path and knocked on the door. She was a nurse, and I think he knocked on the door and she came to the door. And it turned out that that day she'd found out about her brother's death. And so it was actually that death, it was actually that death that brought them together. So that was a constant reminder in our family of the war. On a physical side, I also remember my grandmother telling us stories about, you know, for instance, you know, grandpa would come back from over the farm on a stormy day and there'd be a lightning strike and he'd be sitting on the back porch taking off his gumboots and his muddy gear, and this lightning strike would happen and she'd run out there and find him just sitting there completely white as a sheet. But in my own memory of him, he talked quite freely about the war. If you asked him, he'd tell you about it. And yeah, so in that respect, he must have come to terms with it.
So that was like a trigger, a PTSD trigger. And he'd be white as a sheet when your grandmother came out.
Yes, that's my understanding, that it just triggered him straight back to that moment, to those moments in the war. I mean, I can't possibly understand what that would have been like, but that was the story that was always told.
So your grandmother lost a brother and your grandfather also lost a brother.
Yes.
So your father lost two uncles.
Yes.
Who he never met. And the relationship between your father's parents started literally surrounded by the grief of your grandmother's loss of her own brother.
Yeah, I'd say that it was the cause of our family coming together. Yeah, it was the cause that brought those, my grandfather and grandmother, together.
And yet he was open and he was able to talk about what happened in the war. And you had these pictures over the dining room table.
Mm. Yeah, we were looked over by those two men, those two very young faces, our entire, as we grew up. And of course, you don't know, as you're a young boy growing up or a young person growing up, you see these pictures, you don't know them. But as you get older, you realize the significance of them and why they were so important to be sitting there with us at the dining room table. And I find that really interesting too. It wasn't in the hall. It wasn't where the family photos were. It was right next to the dining room table. They were with us every time we sat down to eat together as a family.
I find that deeply moving, Alistair, that your grandma and your granddad would hold their lost brothers so dearly and not even relegate them to the hallway. You know, the hallway and the stairs are where most family photos go, right? the gallery of cadavers, I call it sometimes, the ghosts that haunt us. But here, over the living, the food, the living place, the dead are in. I find that deeply touching. I don't know why that hits me so hard, but it's really powerful.
I think as we're discussing that, it reminds me of Epicurus. You know, if you read up on Epicurus and his views on the central part that dining plays in our lives, you know, he used to talk about how during the day we go out into the fields and we work and we contribute to the dining room table in whatever way we do, but the one time we all come together is dinner time, when we all come together, and that's the core of the Epicurean philosophy, I believe, that we come together and we talk about our days and we solve our problems together over food. And so that's what comes to mind when we're talking about that for me, as we talk about it and we realize the significance of why those pictures were there.
And I think there is that's so interesting about Epicurus. I didn't know that, actually. It's not someone I've studied, so I'm going to look that up. And I imagine, you know, the readers will want to look up Epicurus as well, because that does sound really interesting. And, you know, there's something about honoring the dead in life that is so important, that our roots And also our traumatic roots must not be forgotten. I mean, that's my work. My work is often having people turn up in distress or whatever and simply laying it out on the floor and saying, look what you're carrying. No wonder you're distressed. We cannot ignore or forget the role of past traumas. I mean, we shouldn't dwell on them and get drowned by them either. But when we hit a moment of crisis or when things go tough, it's very helpful sometimes to recognize what we've been carrying and what is our context. It's like context, isn't it? You know, when you do your films, I reckon you're putting everything into context. In fact, I know you are, because I recently watched your fluoride documentary, which was wonderful, by the way. And anyone who hasn't seen that needs to see it. Beautifully presented, beautifully balanced. And there you were, putting context in the place all the time. Context, 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 right?
Yeah. When you talk about that, it reminds me of something that I think you might find interesting, that throughout my life, I've always had these flashbacks of embarrassment and I think a lot of people get these in different forms, where you think back in life about an instant and you get very embarrassed by it. I have situations where I think back to as young as when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I get this acute embarrassment about something that I did. But when you're talking about the emotional experience and so on, that the way that I found this very debilitating to be thinking back to something that happened when I was 8 years old, and I did something extremely embarrassing that I'd really love to go back and apologize to the young kid who I did it to, or something like that. But you realize after a while that there's no way I can go back and apologize to that kid, because he will have forgotten completely about it. But more importantly, what I discovered as I just looked at it more and more is that the reason that I'm embarrassed about it now is because I realized what I did was wrong. And that's part of actually growing up. And if you didn't realize that it was wrong, you'd still be making the same mistake today, which would ultimately be 100 times more embarrassing to be still completing those same mistakes. And you talk about context and the emotional journey and so on, that I feel like, that was a big part for me, is understanding that, so that we could actually move on and grow as a person. Once you understand that those things were not only unavoidable, but they were actually necessary to become the people we are. That was the only way that I could get past those little traumas, so to speak.
Yeah, that is so interesting, isn't it? That maybe the things that embarrass us the most or shame us the most were the moments where we did the most learning that changed us most powerfully to become the better person.
Mm. And for a lot of the time, it was incredibly debilitating. And I was talking to somebody recently who was recalling a conversation with somebody else, and how that person is really struggling right now. And I mentioned that story, and they said, yeah, okay, I'll go and talk to them about that, because, these are the things which end up holding us, a lot of us, back, but they're also what make us. And it wasn't until I realized that I was able to get over it myself.
Do you know, this is right at the heart of maybe why I think I do this show, because we do touch on family traumas. We do touch on historical traumas. I mean, it, look where this started. It started with a song. And the song went to your grandma and your grandpa. And then suddenly what entered into our conversation was the whole bloody World War. The Second World War. And I already want to ask questions about your grandfather's father and whether he was involved in the First World War, because that was a remarkable generation. Many, many people who fought in the Second World War grew up with dads who had been involved in the First World War. I'm not saying yours was, but we're not going there quite yet. But look at this. Look at the connection between world history. And by the way, my first degree was in, well, my only degree was in history. I studied history at Oxford. And it was like, when I do my psychotherapy work, I think I'm more the historian than I am the psychotherapist sometimes, because I'm wanting to find out how world events are not something you read about in the book. They enter into the very dining room where you're eating your meals, for heaven's sake. They're part of our lives, you know, these tremendously impactful and damaging global horror stories that would never impact on us if the world was lived according to what humanity is about, which I believe is about love, is about community, and is about the very best in humans, bringing out the very best in humans by each other. And yet we have been infected and contaminated by forces at play that we're only now realizing that have been going for maybe hundreds of years, maybe even thousands, that have been trying to distress humanity and convince us that we need, you know, wars and governments and all the things that go with it. And here you are eating lunch at the age of eight, and staring down at you are the is the tragedy of the lost lives of your grandma and your grandfather's brothers.
Isn't that context what reminds us or what teaches us why family, in that particular case, it's why families are so important? You know, you don't know the existence of black without the existence of white, for instance. You know, without these massive world disasters and tragedies that you're talking about, you know, we don't know how important those two men were to our family, or why it's so important that we come together for dinner at that table, breakfast, lunch, and dinner each day. That's the reason for that, is it not? That's why we're on this earth. We're on this earth to learn all these different things. And we don't learn them without those tragedies that we live through. We don't learn the horrors of war without actually going through it, do we?
Well, I do sometimes wonder how much we have learned.
Well, maybe, yeah, maybe that's why we have to keep going through them periodically, because once every 80 years or so, our collective consciousness forgets about how terrible it was, right?
You reckon it's as short as 8 years, do you?
80.
80 sounds more real. Yeah, I thought I heard you say eight.
eight. It's about when your grandparents start to die, you know, everybody has to learn the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
And maybe people talk about the fourth turning, for instance. I think that's pretty much what they're talking about there, isn't it? That goes in about 80-year jumps.
Do you want to explain that, the fourth turning?
Oh, so the fourth turning being that every 20 years or so, our society goes through a change, and it goes through a cycle. So, and there's four turnings. So 2, 4, 6, 80 years is the complete cycle. And the fourth one, which a lot of people think that maybe we're going through today, is the destruction period. And once we go through the destruction period, we'll go into the next 20-year period, which is the rebuilding. And then following that 20-year period of rebuilding, there'll be 20 years of golden age. And then following the 20 years of golden age will be 20 years of decadence. And following that, we'll get back into 20 years of destruction. And so when we think of our period here, you know, if we look back, you know, the period of destruction is now, and the period of decadence was, I suppose, the 80s and 90s. The golden age was perhaps the 70s and 60s, and the previous rebuilding phase was just after World War II, and the previous destruction phase was World War II, perhaps. That's how I understand it. And when you think of that, you think of, you know, my father he was born just after World War II. He was born in 1948, and he died just before the COVID madness started. And I always remember thinking throughout the madness period, thinking, you know, he got lucky, didn't he? He lived through from 1948, didn't get to see the Second World War. He lived through all the golden years, all the way through to all the decadent eras, and he never got to see the destruction period at the end of it. But then I also started thinking towards the end, when I started to get a bit more perspective, is that I feel sorry for him too, because he didn't get to see that period of destruction, that period which actually made us all pretty strong. You know, we learned a lot of strength from this fourth turning period that we're going through. We're learning how to deal with problems which perhaps we couldn't have dealt with before that. We're learning strength. We're learning how to stand up and talk out loud. I hold up my film "We Came Here for Freedom" like that. Before we went down with that convoy, I'd made a series of short documentaries about the protest movement, because I just knew straight from the beginning something was wrong. And you know, but I never put my name on those films, on those short films, because I was so worried about the backlash that I would get, because I'd received some backlash on social media. In fact, one family member had even offered to re-educate me. That was very kind of them. But so when it came to making "We Came Here for Freedom," it was like that. It was, okay, you know what? I've learned all the strength. I'm going to put my name on it now. I'm not going to be frightened of this anymore. So, you know, just going back to the summing back up on that point, was that, you know, my father did live through all those golden years of the previous three turnings, but he missed out on the destructive phase, which is, you know, the strength building phase as well, right?
Totally, totally. But yet that destruction time, I mean, many, many listeners, I've talked to many people and listeners, as you have, who listen to this radio station, and most of us are saying the things I'm hearing is, before this whole COVID eruption, I kind of trusted and I thought I could believe what I was being told. And now I'm thinking critically. Now I'm trusting my intuition. Now I'm looking back, and certainly I'm looking back in history and going, oh my God, how much of the history can we even trust? And the attack on history, we always knew that history is written by the winners, right? But looking back now, we're seeing in this time of destruction, I don't know what you think, but I think we might be seeing the final cycle. These four turnings that you described, the rebuilding, the golden age, the decadence, and the destruction, those are mini cycles to me within a much bigger cycle that I think goes back thousands of years, and that we are now seeing the exposure of some of the darkest forces that have been contaminating and destroying humanity, I think probably as far back as the Egyptians, as my historical analysis.
Oh, where to start with that one, Jerry? There's so many thoughts that I've got on that subject. The first one is that I think it's taught us, one of the biggest things, probably the biggest thing that I've learned from all of this, is to live with faith. I think that to live with faith, to me, is not necessarily, you can name it any different way you like. Some people call it God, some people call it the universe, some people call it Jesus, Muhammad, whatever. But it's to live with faith is to let the greater forces of your fate, or your destiny, or whatever you want to call it, the forces of the universe, to just tune into them and watch it and listen to it and live your life by it. And when you do that, you sort of fall in sync with the universe, and things start to come right. For instance, why did how did I get through the whole COVID pandemic era when we had a situation in our family where we had three businesses and two of them were destroyed by the mandates, by all the madness that went on. But how did we survive through all of that? If we had that much of a destruction in our businesses, and the third business was basically put on life support. So how did we get through that? And that's why I say I learned to live with faith, because it was about, you know, if you do the right thing, if you listen to the universe and you figure out and you listen to what the things that are coming towards you, you know, listening to things like synchronicities, when you see them, you start to realize what it is that you're supposed to be doing. Follow your intuition. That's what I'm talking about there. I found that that was incredibly important to listen to. And so in that respect, when you say, is this then the final turning? I don't actually believe, I have thought on that a lot, but I don't subscribe to it, I suppose you might say, because I feel like this is an infinite cycle that's just going on. And, you know, I think back to, for instance, I was looking recently at some Roman history because I'm really interested in Augustus Caesar. And I was remembering back to the time, one time when I was in Rome, and I was looking at the temple of Augustus, and I was looking at the steps, and I was imagining, I thought to myself, man, Augustus walked up those steps right there. And I was thinking just recently how grand that was, and I was thinking about how grand the Roman Empire was in his time. And then I suddenly realized, you know what, if I lived back in those times, I'd be seeing the end of the world as well. I'd be going, look how corrupt these people are. And I'd be figuring that, because it's just been like that throughout human history, I expect, is that this is this really messy sandpit that we live in, which the universe is using us, or we're here to learn something in this really messy sandpit. And I think in the end, the point that I was trying to get to is that we actually learn that the corruption and the destruction and all of that stuff is just part of this human experience, and there is actually something higher to learn out of all of it. I'm sorry, I'm not sure whether I'm sort of losing my way there a little bit, but it doesn't feel to me like that's the point. The corruption is not the point. The point is that we're supposed to be learning something from this. We're supposed to be growing stronger. You know, the millstone that we've been carrying with this knowledge of the destruction is not there to weigh us down. It's to strengthen us. It's for us to sharpen our swords on, so to speak. That's what I've taken out of all of this.
Well,
that was a very long and rambling reply.
Not at all. No, we're landing on some really big subjects here that are profound. And I think the listeners are going to be really interested in this conversation. I guess if they're not, they'll have switched off. So if you're still listening, you must be interested, right? Hey, great for hanging in there. Just in case you're not sure what you're listening to, this is Reality Check Radio, and you're listening to Jerry Pives, doing an interview with the amazing director of We Came Here for Freedom, and also the Fluoride documentary, and many other things that I'm not going to mention now. But you're on Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair, and we started off with, well, we never got going, did we, Alistair? I've got a list of questions here, and I never even got to the first one.
Maybe you better get onto one of those before I ramble some more.
No, it's not rambling. You see, where we've gone is we've gone from the trauma of warfare into an understanding of what this is all about. What is the purpose? Supposing there's a purpose to everything, and I deeply believe there is, and I absolutely align with you when you talk about, you know what, it's not a millstone. I love that image. It's not a millstone. It's a stone to sharpen our sword with. And I really like that image. What a beautiful image. A millstone hung around the neck weighs us down and confounds us and destroys us. And like we bend over in servitude with that millstone. And what you did with that image is, you know, man, you should become a psychotherapist. Images like that are just wonderful, because Because what you did is you transformed that into something to sharpen an object, a symbol of power, which is the sword. And that power, I don't believe you're talking about as a merely kind of worldly power. You're talking it in terms of our evolution, our spiritual growth, I think. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. I think that each of us contribute as well, right? There is a collective consciousness. And so I think that that's the purpose that we're here for. We're here to strengthen ourselves and sharpen our souls and all of that. And that as a collective, we become stronger. That's how humans behave. That's why we instinctively want to come together. That's why instinctively the whole COVID madness was so soul-destroying, because we were split apart. We were separated. They literally said, you can't be part of society anymore if you're not part of this. I do agree with you there. That's what it's about. It's about the strengthening of us as a, not just individually as well, as a combined force of humanity.
Yeah. Yes, and your image of the repetitive patterns, the four turnings, I think I get that, and I appreciate that, and I value that insight. And yet there is a feeling for me that if it continually repeats, it's like hamsters on a wheel, learning the same things over and over again. And so I think much more along the lines of, no, this has been going on in humanity for a purpose, which is for us to become, well, like angels, for us to become what we were always intended to be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a repetitive, if we look back into the dawn of man, they could never. If you went back there in a time machine today and you showed them our smartphones and we said, we're going to be able to carry these things in our pockets and we're going to be able to talk to someone on the other side of the earth. And not only that, I'm going to be able to show them images of what's going on the other side of the earth instantaneously like that. They're going to look at you and they're going to go, that is absolutely nuts. That's a whole different world, right? So this is why I hesitate on thinking that we're in the end time, so to speak, is because we're trying to consider something, a change, which we can't comprehend ourselves. We're in that moment ourselves at the moment on the brink of something completely different. And I think that this is the blessing of what we've gone through over the last few years, that when I look back on, I always talk about this. I probably talk about it too much, but it does mean, I do think it explains a lot to me of what we're making sense of what we've seen. And it's like when we went to Parliament, we thought we were fighting for freedom. All those protesters thought they were fighting for freedom, but actually it wasn't that at all. It was them fighting to keep control, because we are standing on the abyss. We're standing, looking down into something that we don't know what it is. We are turning into something different. Like when the people went through the industrial age, we're going through the information age revolution at the moment. You know, a good way of explaining that is when the protesters turned up at Parliament that first day, the media turned up and put about 6 or 8 cameras on the balcony of Parliament and pointed them in the direction of the protesters, and they thought that they were going to be able to tell the story of the protest via that method, because that's how they'd always done it. You know, you and I, we grew up and we had radio and we had newspapers and we had television, and those were the things that told the story, that built the narrative that we all lived by. And when the protesters turned up to Parliament, they literally turned up not with 6 or 8 cameras. They turned up with thousands of cameras. That's why someone like Chantelle Baker was so important to it, because she was getting millions of views simply because she was one of many of these people on social media. So think about that when we're thinking about the change from what would we be considered to be in the modern age, the industrial age, whatever, to the information age. is that the media is no longer newspapers, radio, and television. It's every one of us. We are all media today. And that's the profound difference between what went before and what is now. And that's why we're struggling, because we're actually rewriting the social contract now, right? We're changing everything. That's why it feels so damned uncomfortable. And it feels like the rug is being pulled out from underneath us, and we're all sort of in free fall, and we're all so used to standing on solid ground, but we've got to, now we're suddenly learning how to be comfortable floating in midair and flying through air or something. I don't know. It's a completely different knowledge of who we are. And so, yeah, going back to that, the initial point, that are we actually in the end times? Because this is just too crazy. This is speeding up too fast. This and so on. I'm thinking that maybe it's just because we can't comprehend what we're about to go into. We're still clinging on to what we were before. And in essence, what we're doing on RCR is we're clinging on to what we had before, aren't we? We're still trying to cling on to the radio model. But we've got to somehow learn to be comfortable floating in midair, because, and human beings have never floated in midair before. It's like going and telling a caveman about the smartphone.
Well, listen, that can bring me right back to one of my questions. Okay, so let's get back in our gumboots, land back on the ground. And I love this discussion, and I'm sure the listeners will be interested in this discussion and have much to say. And by the way, write in, tell me what you think. Tell me if you agree. Tell me if you disagree. Tell me if what you like, and tell me if you don't like. I'll take it all. Send a text at 2057. Come on, do it now. Just send a text. Tell us what you're thinking of this stuff. And send an email to inbox@realitycheck.radio. Tell me how you're getting on with this show. I love to hear from you. I love to know how you're doing. You're my people, and this show is for you. So write back and let's engage, because that's kind of different as well, isn't it? That there's a conversation going on all the time with RCR. It's a continuous stream of giving and receiving. It's much more fluid than the traditional radio or TV stations. I could never get in touch with the presenters on TV and stuff. But, you know, people have met you, Alistair. You know, people have met me. We bump into each other. And if I don't know the person listening, I've met someone really like you, someone with your concerns or worries and whatever. But let's go back to the first question on my list of questions. And we're almost at the end of our interview. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. But, you know, what is it? Here's the question. How do you cope? What works for you? What practical tools do you use when you just feel like I've had too much? I can't take any more of this. When it's become a millstone rather than a sword sharpener, when the weight of what you're discovering, the weight of what you're experiencing has become so much that you're overwhelmed, what do you do and what works?
When you first started asking the question, I was thinking, man, I don't know how I'm going to answer this, but thankfully you elaborated. And I always think back to this one lady. There's a monastery near where I live. And I went along one time to hear the Mother General from England had come out and was speaking there. And afterwards, I was talking to the lady who invited me, and she worked at the monastery. I don't think she's a nun, but she works there, and she was the one that had invited me. And I asked her at the time, I found the talk that the Mother General had given was so interesting. I said, can I interview you and can I interview the Mother General? And this woman said, I'll ask about the Mother General, but I don't think I want to be interviewed. And I said, why not? You're so interesting. And she said, no, I'm just really working hard at the moment on being nobody and knowing nothing. And she said, you know what I do here? I clean the toilets. So that's what I do, and I enjoy it. And that's what I'm focusing on at the moment. And so if you ask that question, I think that's what I keep coming back to, is that so we live out in the countryside, and I really enjoy living out here because I find that at the end of the day, I down tools and I go out and I do some work like, I don't know, pulling out blackberry roots or something, something really physical, which doesn't require that much brain power. But it's just so nice. Or working with the animals, with the chickens, or I've got a couple of cows and so on, and just getting my hands in the earth. I find that that's really important. But it all comes back to that point, that idea of just know nothing for a little while. And I find that that calms me down a lot because we don't know. I feel like we live in the age of hubris. You know, everybody thinks that they know everything at the moment. Everybody thinks they can fix everything with an app or with an mRNA injection or something like that. We don't know everything, and we don't need to know everything either.
Oh, I just want to get outside right now.
That's why people love exercise, right? They get out on their bikes in the bush, or they go running or something like that. It's the same thing. So that's how I think that's how I deal with what you're asking about there, if things get a little bit too tough.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Alistair. That is a lovely description of you know, getting your hands in the mud, in the earth, being with animals, pulling up blackberry roots, getting physical outdoors. I would say that this is what returns again and again and again on my program. When I ask that question, it's not the same answer, but it's similar. And being nobody and doing nothing is such a beautiful way to describe letting go, right? Letting go of the desires of the ego, letting go of the need to be recognized, perhaps, letting go of the need to be significant, but simply immersing ourselves in the job at hand, cleaning the toilets. Do you know, for years I've been saying the real way to train doctors for their first year of study should be to clean the toilets of the hospitals, because without that, they don't know anything. Unless you clean up the shit that others leave behind, you really don't know what humanity is about. And I think, you know, we're all doing a bit of shit clearing, aren't we? We're all trying to clear up our own act. We're all trying to clean up what's going on in society. We're all trying to get to truth. But something about nature, something about being human, and something about being a small part of a much bigger picture. I don't know. That's what hits me from what you've said.
Well, especially in this day and age, right? When technology, there's this worship of technology at the moment, and we forget what it means to be human. To be human is to be entirely natural. You know, we came into this world, our parents didn't go and buy parts and stuff. And when we break down, we don't go and buy a spare part at the body store or something like that. We are nature. But I feel like we're losing sight of that somewhat in our worship of technology. And when I hear people like, I can't remember his name right now, Noah Harari or something, the guy from the WEF.
Harari.
When he talks about how, oh, we're better than God now. We know more than God. I mean, that's what I mean by the age of hubris. You know, this guy, he's got a big face plant coming up in his life. I guarantee it. Because for some reason, these guys think that they can inject our human bodies, our purely natural human bodies, with something, and they're going to know the outcomes. But you talk to any doctor about how many times they've seen. I've got a friend who's a nutritionist, and he talks about this a lot, about how sometimes people, you know, they go into the doctor and they've got a small little problem, and so they get a pill for that, and then they have to get another pill to counter the side effects on that. And then this and then that. And the next thing you know, they're in hospital for an operation and that goes wrong, and they end up, you know, living the rest of their life in a wheelchair. You know, we have this worship of technology and this misunderstanding that we understand everything. And I guess that goes back to the I know nothing I want to just want to be know nothing and be nobody for a little while. It's just going back to that understanding of what it is to be human.
Well, great words of wisdom coming here from this discussion. And I really think that we're accessing, you talked about the collective unconscious. Sometimes I think when we have these conversations and we're talking about how do we frame our experiences? And I trust that on some level, Alistair, that there is a collective something. I'm not sure if it's unconscious. That's how Jung talked about it. But there is a shared there is a shared unity, that we're all connected. And that when you and I do a conversation like this, sometimes I can feel the pressing of the questions of many, many listeners saying, ask him this, ask him that. You know, like we're evolving something. And where have we got to? In this conversation, we've actually got to faith. You started it actually with faith. And faith is about where do we place our faith? And we talked about Harari placing in his faith in himself.
Yeah.
Well, in my faith, that is the ultimate sin. That is the sin of Satan, to say that we are better than God. That is the ultimate sin. And the hubris that you describe fits in so beautifully with my own spiritual journey, which is as a Christian. But I was a very kind of secret Christian working in New Age world. And I figured everyone has their own faith and I shouldn't. And so many people get upset by Christianity. So many people get upset if you say you're a Christian or you mention the Bible. And it's like, when all this started to happen, I was rubber banded straight back into silence, into prayer, and into opening my heart to the fact that I was nothing. I am nothing compared to the glory and love and beauty of God. And it became so important that this kind of polite little secretive Christian who was brought up in an Anglican cathedral ended up taking about 100 steps out of my house, and I've been resisting it for 2 years, took 100 steps across the road to a local church. It's a Pentecostal church. It's a big, New Zealand has some amazing churches actually. And before I'd been going there for very long, I just knew I had to do something active. And I got myself baptized in Lake Wanaka in a traditional first century kind of Christian apostolic way. And I had to go out there and be exposed and say what I believed and fall back and be covered by water and be held by the guys doing it with me. It was so raw. It was so simple. And since then, I felt, yeah, I know what this shit show's about. It's about the very core issue of who's going to be boss on this planet. And I vote for God. I bend the knee to God and I bend the head. I bow the head. I don't bow to anyone but my God. And I don't know what your religion is, but I just wanted to share that because this has been the core root discovery. I am so grateful for what has happened because I was brought to my knees by what this government did and what happened here. And I am so thankful because they brought me to my knees and I knew I will bend that knee to nobody but the creator of our universe.
Yeah, I can't agree anymore. They tried to break all of that, but actually they made it stronger. They tried to break it all, but we all found a way to it in whatever form we are. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you started by talking about this, the general unconscious, sorry, the collective unconscious. You mentioned about that. You know, I think of those trees or the fungi in the forest or something. They're all connected underneath the earth, and they're all talking to each other for tens of thousands of kilometers, I understand, underneath. And I think that's what that faith is. You know, I'm of the opinion that there are lots of different ways to have that same conversation. That's how I feel about it, that all these different religions, I get a little bit angry when I hear people say, oh, there's only one true religion. I think they're just different ways of talking to the same thing. That's how I feel about it. And so that's why I usually sort of frame those discussions with, oh, you can call it, whether you call it the universe or you call it God or whatever. I tend to think of it as God because that's the way I was brought up. And it's extraordinary that I was quite a militant atheist before all of this madness started off, but they brought me back to God. They really did. And, you know, I'd want to mention something actually on that topic. Have you heard of the music producer, Rick Rubin? He was the music producer for the Beastie Boys. He started producing music, recording music in his dorm room in New York City. And I really recommend you have a listen to this guy. He's deeply spiritual. And he talks about creativity. And he's produced, you know, so many music acts, all the way from the Beastie Boys to the likes of Johnny Cash and comedy shows like Andrew Dice Clay, for instance. I believe he even recorded him. But he's been extraordinarily successful. And I have a book that he wrote. It's called The Creative Act of Living. And one of the things, the thing that really struck me in that is, and it comes back to faith, he talks about how as a creative person, you put your antenna up and you listen and you get ideas. These ideas aren't our own ideas. They're just ideas that God has sent to us through the universe. And when we put our, this is what living by faith means to me, is that you put up your antenna and you listen to what God's telling you. And as a creative person, you know, we listen to these things and we grab hold of them. And say, for instance, there was one example that I always remember. A friend of mine many years ago, he watched that film Ants, which I've never seen, but I understand it was really popular. It was really famous. And he watched that film and then he started telling me and my mates. He said, they stole my idea. And what Rick Rubin, I'll bring this back to Rick now, Rick Rubin would say is that idea wasn't your idea. It was God's idea. It was the idea that was coming through the universe. And you stuck your antenna up and you heard it, but you did nothing about it. And so somebody else grabbed it and they did it. And so that to me is what the collective unconsciousness is. It's God talking to us all, or the universe talking to us all. And that's how we come up with our ideas and how we act on them and so on. That's God talking to us. And you know what? Like I said, they tried to break that away from it. They tried to break us all away from that. They're still trying to do it by telling us that they know more than God. But they've pushed more of us back to God than they could have possibly imagined.
I knew I would love this conversation with you, Alistair. Let me try and wrap it up. And I'm very happy for you too as well, but I've got a picture here, which is that somehow we started with World War II. I don't know why we landed there. It started with Louis Armstrong. I think I'm going to blame Louis Armstrong.
It was Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, that's it. And What a Wonderful World. And we're talking about the, because it's broadcast, I call it a cluster duck, the cluster duck of our current day. You talked about it as being a time of destruction. I think that's very accurate too. And we talked about Harari, and we talked about who stands above the hubris of trying to be more than we are. Like when we're with an animal, or we're growing blackberries, or we're doing something with children, or when we're just doing a simple thing, we're kind of in touch with the greater picture, and all this technology would have us actually be insignificant, secondary. They're talking about losing jobs now to AI. I don't know why anyone would ever use anything to do with AI. It's a contaminant. Don't touch it. It's toxic, I believe. But I feel like that about a lot of stuff. But when we come back to the beginnings of this conversation, the role of remembering, the effects of trauma. That Second World War was funded by the same people, the same families that have benefited and funded this whole COVID situation. That the Second World War was funded by the whole Rockefeller, Rothschild, collaborations that went on with the big wealthy families. The money for Hitler came from America, for example. That would be an amazing bit of history I discovered. I thought, whoa, why am I not surprised? But what I'm getting at here is we're talking about how we come back to a simple choice. Each moment of each day is how we live our lives and what belief structure we place ourselves in. Chaos, destruction, the millstone, or that stone that can be used to sharpen us and lift us to a belief where we are just a part of something so much more magnificent than man could ever imagine. And that's been our conversation, Alistair, and I'm uplifted by your conversation, this conversation, and hearing what you have to say. I just want to say that.
I'm speechless. Thank you. I hope it has been. I feel like I've been rambling. So, yeah, that's good to hear.
Well, man, if that's rambling, ramble on. keep rambling. So we're going to take a break now, and I'm going to invite you back later on to talk about the music that Rubber Bands. I hope we get more than past one piece of music. I've got 7 tracks I want to hear from you, but, you know, we'll have to bite on it a bit just to get through 7 tracks of music. But has this been in the psychotherapist chair? And I believe it has, because in a very small way, we touched on just one historical event that affected your family, Alistair, and it's launched us into the critical place that I often end up with clients is, what is your belief structure? How do you frame your everyday tasks? How do you frame brushing your teeth? How do you frame your time with family? Where do you place yourself? What is the overarching picture in which you live your life? Because I believe we could have got by until this cluster duck happened without really thinking about it. But now we've got to think about it. Now it's in our face. And I'm hearing so many people talk about faith, about spirituality, about psychology. We've learned so much over these last 4 years. We've been forced to learn. We've had to see it, haven't we?
You know, the way that you framed that, I can see now what you've been doing. I can see your genius there, Jerry. You know, going back to the beginning, you know, where you start there with the family and with those two pictures of those two great uncles of mine looking down on us.
Can you name them? Can you give them their names?
Rollo and Eric.
Oh, bless Rollo and Eric. They should have lived, man. They should have lived.
Well, so this is where I think that you've brought this to, which is really, really nice, and I understand this now, is that, you know, we started there, and I went out into the world from that dining room table, and I lived in various places. I lived for many years outside of New Zealand, you know, as far away as I could get from all of those structures and family traditions and all of those things that as a young man, I probably tried to flee. You know, I wanted to make my own mark in the world. And then I came back to New Zealand, and we had this, and like I mentioned during that, you know, I often think about my father, how he lived through the golden years and he never saw the destructive years. And I, you know, I thought about how blessed he was to be able to do that, but then also to realize that, you know, through all of that, we came back, and all of that destruction actually brings you back to that dining room table. What's that dining room table? It's tradition. It's the rock that holds us all together. You know, we just mentioned just a few moments ago about how it's all brought us all back to faith in God as well. You know, these are the things that actually matter. You know, you ask, you know, how do you relax after you get to some sort of trauma? You go back to what you know, which is getting your hands in the earth. It's getting back to nature, getting back to who we actually are. And that's You know, one way of putting it would be to say we're God's children. You need to get back to listening to God, listening to the universe, listening to nature. So I find that really interesting that that's the way this conversation's gone, because we did start at that dining room table, and I feel like I went away for many years over to Singapore and wherever else I went to, but I ended up back at that dining room table.
Well, Alistair Harding, bless you, and bless your great work that you do for us all. And thank you for sitting with me, Jerry Pives, in the psychotherapist chair. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry. This has been fun.
This is my reflections on Alistair Harding's wonderful session. Oh, my goodness. I don't know where to start, really. There are so many directions to go on. I'm going dizzy. I think it's the Acid House DJ version. it's frazzled me brain. Testillo. He's got too much testosterone, hasn't he? World famous DJ, eh? Yeah, he's got me wired. And isn't that interesting what that stuff does? But look, I want to talk about Alistair Harding. And I want to focus on what I think is something that relates to us all these days. And I wonder, have you ever wondered about why it is you see things a certain way and how that might differ from somebody else? And in some ways, why human conversation is so exciting and interesting and sometimes full of conflict. But have you wondered why some people just can't see some things that you can? And this is pretty relevant, isn't it, for today? Many of us are walking around, sort of having to step around the bomb craters of what's been going on right across the world. A psycho-spiritual world war is going on. And many of us feel like we're having to divert around, you know, mile-long craters just to get through our day. And there are some people, you know, also diverting around these bloody big mile-long psycho-spiritual craters. And just going, no, everything's just normal, you know, no. Bomb crater? What do you mean? Where? I can't see any bomb craters. No, this is just an ordinary diversion. The council's probably looking after us by allowing this to happen. We just need to divert. Hey, chin up, get on with it, you know. Well, here's a bit of psychological theory that might help you navigate that. It certainly helps me. You see, there is something in psychology called frame of reference. And frame of reference pretty much describes our beliefs. In other words, our frame of reference dictates what we see and what we do not see. That we all kind of focus on different things, but the frame of reference is a particularly powerful concept because it is like a frame of blindness. The way I think about it is that we have a frame of reference that we built up for ourselves when we were very little. And it's like we put on glasses. And these glasses filter out any colors that we decide are not important to see. So if you imagine yourself putting on a pair of glasses and those glasses only let in blue light, then what's happening is, as you walk around, there's all the colors of the rainbow coming at those glasses. But the only thing that you let into yourself and into your eyes will be blue. Now, that's a little metaphor for this. So what happens is, at a very young age, we come up with beliefs and ideas about how the world works. Now, some of that is literally passed down by our parents. We take it on board. We swallow it hook, line, and sinker. But some of it is based on how we get by in a family that is maybe not absolutely functional. It's like, you know, most psychotherapists that I know, most of us are in psychotherapy because, you know, we had a frame of reference that worked very well to survive as children. That's why we're still here. So it's very important to have a frame of reference. We developed a way of operating and what we see and what we don't see. in order to survive highly dysfunctional families. And so when we're faced with the real world, a world that doesn't function like our family, so the likelihood of the world operating in the same way as our individual family operated is very slim. So all of us, to some extent, have to make this adjustment in growing up, especially when we leave home, when we first of all leave home, it might be for work, it might be for college, it might be on some trip, and we start to have to configure and adjust our frame of reference, which we developed to survive in our family, to the realities of the big wide world. Now, if we don't make that adjustment successfully, and by the way, many of us don't, because we're so locked in to our survival patterns, they become so embedded to our very survival that they feel threatening to change. So we end up with quite a lot of conflict in relationships, in work, in careers, in our sense of ourselves. We reinforce, actually, some of the worst patterns and belief structures, because we only are seeing the blue. When we survived in our family, it was very important not to see red, orange, or yellow. And so life doesn't really work out for us, but we are locked in to this frame of reference. These spectacles will only let us see the blue. And the bad news is, most of us had this frame of reference locked in before the age of five. That's the one thing that almost all psycho professions agree on. But by psycho professions, I'm not talking about a profession of psychos. I just want to make that quite clear. I'm talking about psychological professionals. Whether that's psychiatry or psychoanalysis, or it's psychology or it's psychotherapy, these groups disagree on almost everything except this one thing. Maybe, I don't want to do a disservice to the psychologists, but maybe they don't subscribe to the idea of the first 5 years, although there's plenty of research to show the power of it. So I don't know. You'd have to ask a psychologist. I will. But what I'm saying here is that our frame of reference dictates what we see and what we don't see. Now, we need to adjust that to reality, but why don't we? The question that always made me wonder was, for example, for me personally, I couldn't work out why the hell it took me so long to work out what works in life. It was like I'm facing a brick wall, and I know there's a door somewhere, but I just can't see it. So the only way I can find it is by bashing myself repeatedly against the brick wall until one day, by accident, I fall through and I go, ah, that's how it works. In other words, I'm sharing a little bit of a personal stuff of my own, which is that, you know, I grew up in it wasn't a dysfunctional family. It was a nuclear disaster, mainly. And I love my parents deeply and dearly. But, you know, truth is truth. It was a disaster, which meant that when I hit my early 20s, I was hitting up against some serious brick walls. And the only thing I found myself actually capable of was understanding what it was like to hit against brick walls. Where did I end up? I ended up as a therapist, because people came and see me and I used to go, oh yeah, I completely understand it. And they go, do you? How do you? I says, well, of course I understand it. It's what happens to a lot of us. And they go, oh, thank God for that. You know, and over the last 40 years, I've learned and studied and worked very hard to understand why we can't shift that frame of reference. So what I'm saying is, when you're talking to someone who literally cannot see the truth, they cannot see the reality, they stick their heads in the ground, they say that there's no herd of elephants in the sitting room, they say there are no bomb craters as they go about their daily business, and bless them, that they have been locked into a frame of reference. But now this frame of reference that they're locked into is an induction. No question about it. And we're talking more and more about this, because this is kind of the biggest issue, isn't it? How do we help those people who are locked in? Well, how do you help someone who's hypnotized? And I think we have to think of it like sleepwalking. We have to be oh so very gentle, because when they wake up, they're going to find themselves standing on the edge of a 90-story building, right? That's how we should think of people who cannot see what's in front of their eyes. It's like they've got a metaverse attached to their head, you know, one of these appalling contraptions that stops you seeing reality and gives you Mark Zuckerberg's reality. Well, no, thank you. No, I think any psychosis I want to live in, I would like it to be my own, not his. And however bad I am, I'm nothing close to that poor fella. So what I'm saying here is, if you imagine someone wearing one of these awful kind of cutting out God, cutting out people, cutting out life, metaverse contraptions on their heads, and they think they're walking through a meadow, and actually they're walking up a 90-story building, they get in the elevator, and they come out on the top floor, and they climb up to the roof, and they stand on the ledge. Now, you're there, and you say, whoa! Careful, there's a ledge there, but you don't want to shock them. So the only way I know, and all my life's work has been about doing this, changing, helping people change the frame of reference to something, letting a bit more light, a little bit more reality, a little bit more of what works, you know, and coming into reality. So the only way I know that works is to gently walk up next to them, you know, so that if they startle when their eyes open, when the blindfold comes off, you grab them hard and you hold them safe and you keep them from falling off the ledge, because that ledge is our sanity. If you want to hold on hard to something really important, a solid stability, then absolute truth is one way to go. And that means you don't want them to kill themselves and you don't want them to kill another. So they're standing on the ledge and you're about 20 yards behind them and you can see the danger. So you gently enter their world, enter their dream, get close to them, make connection, be in relationship, so that as they wake up, you're close enough to grab their arms and hold them safe. That is the only way I know to help someone, because you actually cannot break or change another person's frame of reference. I tried. Trust me, I tried. I tried. I was so enamored of my own brilliance when I was young, I really thought I could smash it. And even if I had temporary success, it always returned. So I learned to respect that frame of reference. I learned to respect it. I actually came to love it because I saw that that was the unpacking. That was the prison that they were locked in. And I wanted to reach them. So I had to kind of close my eyes and feel the bricks and mortar and hunt with them, hold them in one hand and hunt with them to find the doorway into reality. So that's Jerry's reflections after talking with Alistair Harding. I hope that's helped. Write in and tell me what you think. Share your stories.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.